And hello, good morning, afternoon, whatever time of day it is, I don't really know. Today's show is a good one. I'm pretty excited about it. I've got a good friend of mine on today called Tim Redman. He's an actor, writer, an improv performer, and he teaches as well. He does workshops, etc., and performs with the improv group called Impro Melbourne. These guys do shows and workshops and all that sort of stuff all over the place, all the time. So you can totally check out their website. They've also got an Instagram page you can check out. Tim's performed and taught all over Australia. He's also done workshop groups in Texas. He's been invited to do workshops in Toronto as well, Canada. That's Canada. He's just a damn good guy to chat to, which is why I got him on. He's just a wealth of knowledge with scripts and what can make a film good or shit. If you're listening to it, watching him, and you get bored, he's pretty good at dissecting scenes and how things work and why things work. So, and he's also just a good general life person. So get on board with this one, sit down, buckle up, hang on, it's a good ride. Here he is, Tim Redman.
The musical, what do you reckon?
Oh, I think it's just dropped it.
Sorry, man.
That was the first one. We get literally 2 seconds in, I hit record and you drop.
You can edit that out. That's good signs.
Yeah, I think this is the first podcast where I'm going to have to put like explicit content on.
All right.
It's my listen to what you sound like.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very fucking much. Oh my god.
There I am.
There you go. Sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's certain got authority now when you hear yourself back in your ears.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I do now. I'm more comfortable with it now.
Are you?
That's probably from doing my own podcast. You just get bored by the sound of your own voice and your own ideas.
I've been 50-50 with the headphones where I've been either keeping them on or I've been taking them off. Where like people, I think the guests have been like, oh, I don't really want to hear myself. So we just take them off and I don't really... I don't really do anything. I did the podcast, but I don't have them on, and it's worked out fine.
So you'd be used to your voice because you're an actor, how you look on a 50-foot screen.
My voice is the one thing that I've been through my whole life where I feel like that's one of my weaknesses.
I've
never liked my voice. I've worked really hard on it, and I've got this constant raspy sort of broken husky sort of sound, and I can't fix it. And it's because I had one voice person saying to me, a voice coach saying to me, that it's because I was a bit of an athlete when I was younger, and so athletes tend to get damage done to their vocal cords, to their larynx.
From what?
Tearing, just from the heavy breathing, from running and shouting. And
because you're a rugby player, weren't you?
No, I played hockey.
Okay.
Yeah, played and golf, although golf's not, doesn't have the most, you don't exert a lot.
There's not too much heavy breathing unless no. You're, you know, climbing a tree to get your club back.
Or going for a swim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're turning golf into an aerobic sport, you're not doing it right.
You're not doing it right. Although they have this thing called speed golf that we used to play in New Zealand. You have a time limit. So you'd have to, and it was pretty quick. So you're running. So you have about 5 minutes to finish a hole.
With a full bag?
No, it's less than that. You're running. You don't even stop to have a... You don't even stop. You have to run and swing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's full on.
I like the sound of that, actually. I'm a terrible golfer.
Minute, 2 minutes a hole. You just run up. And just
whack.
Yeah, it's like polo without the horse.
Geez, there's a real incentive to hit him straight then, so you don't have to run. This is a 500-meter hole. I've run 9K.
Well, that's what you do. You end up, I think... Most golf games, I would end up walking about 7 or 8 Ks.
All right.
Yeah. It's a long time. Golf's a hell of a sport, isn't it?
It's definitely a sport. There are some sports where I'm a golfer or I'm not a golfer. I'm not a golfer. I've tried it. It's just
Have you
not
tried
for me.
Golf?
Yeah. Don't, it's frustrating. Don't
you don't golf?
No, I'm terrible at it. And it makes me so angry, I just get worse at it.
Really?
Yeah.
So golf is like, I haven't played golf. My clubs have been sitting there in the corner of the room for a...
Taunting you.
Yeah. For, I think about 18 months was the last time I played.
Yeah.
And I view golf like I view surfing. It's like a bit of a switch off moment.
Really?
Yeah.
What happens when you put one into the drink?
Switch off. Reset to the next.
Wow. Okay. Zen.
Yeah. Reset.
Surfing, I get.
Yeah. Well, I was actually, Leo and I were chatting about surfing, and he said he heard, that's one of those third person viewing things, but he said that he heard from someone that surfing is the only thing when you're on a wave, you can't think about anything else other than surfing.
I get that. I think it's the value of any sport, being present, right? When your body's in motion, you can't be thinking about, what am I doing? When I run is my thing. Yeah. It's just the way that for 20 minutes, I'm not going to be thinking because I can't, because I'm too tired and I want to stop, you know? So you just don't have the space to let all the doubts creep in. So I think for anyone who does anything, yeah, get your body doing something.
Yeah.
Even just weaving a basket, whatever it is, making a cup of tea, there's something in that you're forced to be present. And that's a good state to be in, just to switch all the voices off, all the things. As soon as you sit down at a computer to do that draft, they come, oh, me, you need me. The 9 or 10 different voices with the 9 or 10 different ideas, you know, competing for your attention.
How do you separate those ideas and those voices?
If you can tell me, let me know. Chapterizing is a good one for me.
What's that?
I'll set a timer and just write or create to time. And when the timer goes off, I stop. And then I either reset it or go back. It just allows me not to think about how many pages have I done. That's the only way. With most tasks, I'll do that. If I've got to clean or something I don't want to do, which I never want to write.
Really? You don't like writing?
No, I hate it. It's fucking hell.
I agree.
It's hell, but the hell of not doing it, the guilt, is worse. So you have to do it. And that's as optimistic as I'm going to get.
I think of that. That's chocolate for me.
Chocolate?
Unfortunately, chocolate. I don't like eating it, but I have to. Because
that's an abuse of what I'm talking about. How dare you? How dare you, sir?
I think that's the truth.
All right, but that's your truth, bro. I don't want to... You have your truth. I'll have my facts.
Yeah, and I'll end up having my fats for sure.
Yeah, it's my soul needs it. It's not me. I'm doing this on behalf.
That's exactly what it is. My soul needs the chocolate.
I know. I go without. I mean, I'm mocking you a bit. That as well. A bit of pleasure, a reward. But mostly the only way I've found to not hate myself is to set a timer and just go until that timer goes off. And even if I'm just sitting there looking at that cursor going, you know, thinking, fuck you, every time it blinks. I've been there for that 40 minutes. I turned up. And so that's less punishment when I'm finished.
And what happens if you're on a roll and you're like, fuck, I really don't want to stop?
I reset and go again. That's a really good feeling. That's the best feeling.
Oh, yeah. So you just start the stopwatch.
Yeah, like 40 minutes. It's an achievable time frame. Sometimes 20 minutes if it's a rough day. Just enough to get in the habit. Well, I sat here for 20 minutes. It's a great feeling if you've done it and you've done half a page and you go, I'm in the middle of an idea. I want to see where this goes.
Yeah.
It's a great feeling hitting the clock again.
That's a really good idea. Emma's told me to do that a few times because I get sidetracked with doing 4 or 5 different things at once.
You're a machine. The draft machine.
Well, I think it's one of those false amenities. It doesn't exist. It's like, it looks like I'm busy, but I'm busy doing fuck all.
Oh, is it really? You think is that what's going on?
Like every now and then I'll get in a mode like last night, I'll get in a mode and I'll just punch through and get heaps done. And then there's other days where I'm writing, but I'm not writing. I'm not cleaning. I'm doing the dishes, but I'm not really doing the dishes. I'm sitting out in the sun having a cup of tea, which I'm not really doing that.
Wow, man, that's nine layers of procrastination.
Yeah, well, bro, there is a lot of monkeys on that back.
What are they? Name them. What are the monkeys called?
Oh, they're just all, oh, prick, fuckwit, get off, leave me.
I'm just going to
I should be doing something else. Yeah, this is the droopy mic.
Droopy mic.
You got to really like squeeze the, give that handle.
This one?
Yeah, give it a good tighten.
There we go. That's me tightening it.
Yeah.
It's good and hard now.
I don't know. It's constant droop. It's so frustrating. I'm going to pause it.
I think, that other time when I should have been writing, I went and had a coffee. Now I've got to hate myself when I have coffee. Who would be a writer? It's not romantic. There's that. I don't know if you have this idea that if you're not Hemingway, why are you bothering? And I don't think even Hemingway was Hemingway.
I think Hemingway was like, he had moments, flashes of brilliance and then like searing crap.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. You read a good sentence. That's a good sentence. But you know that if I'm not writing the greatest thing, or something that's going to change, why bother? And that's quite a high standard. But it's there. You know, I gotta own it. It's the great pressure on me. Oh, if this isn't perfect, why am I bothering? I gotta wait for it to be perfect. I should go wash the dishes and have a cup of tea and wait for that idea to magically become perfect.
So you think that is definitely one of the main obstacles and hurdles faced with young or up and, not even young, but just writers that want to write is facing that hurdle of trying to make the perfect draft, the first draft, or having that book or that script or that poem completed without rewriting it, or just like, I need each sentence to be perfect, and then editing as you go versus knocking it out and rewriting it.
It is for me, definitely. It's like, if this is not the, you know, an artifact of inspiration, it's not art, when actually the people who I'm most inspired by and the teachers I've had who have had the most impact on me are that nuts and bolts get to work.
Sure.
Your job is to create pages. Create 100, 10 of them might be something that you're proud of. One of those might survive a copy edit. That's a terrible, terrible ratio. But what else are you going to do? You're going to think it into existence? No, you've got to put your fingers down. You've got to make shapes on the paper. And it's an easy thing to say, but it's kind of when I feel the best about myself as a writer is when I've done that. I've written 5 pretty good chunky pages that later on I'll be able to knock them into shape, into something then that I'm ready, that I'm proud enough of that I can give confidently to someone else who can then tear it to shreds. But I've got to get to that moment where I think I've done all I can with this.
Yeah.
Now I can hand it off to someone else and they can read it with completely new eyes. And
is that something that you're learning to enjoy more of, or have you always enjoyed that?
Learning to hate less rather than enjoy more.
Okay.
It's so threatening handing my work to someone else. Yeah, the fear of loss of esteem, of humiliation, of, you know, today's the day they find out, what are you doing? You're a fraud.
Or you haven't actually done anything that we talked about, or nothing's actually changed.
Yeah.
That's my biggest fear. Well, there you go. There's probably brutal honesty in it myself, is handing something to someone and feeling like I've changed a lot when nothing's changed at all.
That's interesting. Because you, my experience of your drafts is you change everything, man. you get in there with the machete and chop stuff around.
But sometimes I feel like that chopping's just, it's not even really doing anything, just chopping and putting the same colour back.
That's a terrible feeling, isn't it? You do all this work and I've just got a different version of an average scene now.
Sure, yeah. Well, rather than actually getting to what that scene means.
Which is the hard part. That's the work, I think.
What is that when someone says to you, like, that's one of the questions that I struggled with really early on, and I think I still do sometimes, is when people say, what does the scene really mean?
Hmm.
What's the scene really about? What is that for you?
Yeah, that'd be a hard question for me to answer. Something in me resists the way that question's phrased. What does this mean? I mean, I guess I would interpret into my head, why'd I ask, and this maybe other people may think this is a silly, but what's the scene doing?
Sure.
What's the consequence of us reading this? I think that's what they're probably asking. If that's, what does this scene mean? It seems such a grave word, though. What's the meaning of the scene? I don't know. It's two characters having a beer and they disagree about the footy scores and then they have a fight. What's it mean? I don't know. I'll tell you when I've got all the scenes in an order, and I'll, you know, maybe in the 4th or 5th draft, I'll start getting a really good idea. Oh, I've actually had this to say. That's for me. I don't know if it's for you. I don't find out till quite late in the drafting what it is I'm actually trying to say. And if I have that in front of me when I'm doing first drafts, it's going to lock me down. I'm going to write stuff that's trying to prove a point, which is fine. Some writers are great at doing that. Not me. It traps me into, again, trying to make it so important because I'm trying to prove something, which is a terrible instinct to bring to the page. Although I do, I'm trying to prove something. Why else am I writing? I'm trying to make something to show I'm important because look what I can make. But that's enough. That's enough to try to prove without having to prove a political point or a thematic point or, you know, how good a writer I am.
So when you're facing a scene and you're working with what the scene is about, is that for you the core of the scene? Is that like it doesn't matter about the characters, or it doesn't matter about the overall story? It just matters what the crux of that scene is.
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It's because all of those things are part of it, right? Everything is as critical as everything else. You can get a note about your characters are behaving illogically, or they're doing something that the writer wants them to do, or you can say, oh, I don't think that character would say that. That sounds like you're trying to say that, you know, all the other things. I don't know if you can get it out fast. And there's a writer I really like, Jez Butterworth. He's a playwright. He wrote a play called Jerusalem, which I've never seen the production of, but it's become this kind of mythic production I never saw. But I love reading that play. I'll read that play a couple of times a year.
Right on.
Just for the thrill of reading a writer's work and having that feeling like, this is magic. This is not writing. This is magic, what he's done. It's not. He just typed stuff in a row. The basic premise of Jerusalem is an old, kind of an old gypsy elko living in a caravan out the back of, I think it's Sussex or somewhere in London, where the housing estates are creeping out. So he's getting pushed out and he's an old broken down daredevil, and just follows that day when he finally gets evicted. But Jez Butterworth was talking about that play and he said, oh, I didn't really have anything to say. I didn't have a goal. I knew I was interested in how we've lost mythology in the suburbs, how, you know, these new estates just kind of flatten everything out and start again with nothing. And I have that, if you go to new estates, that kind of feeling of restlessness and sadness.
Yeah.
That all these houses get built in the same 3 months and it all just appears. But his thing was, I just wanted to write, Jez Butterworth was saying, I just wanted to write one thrilling thing after another, something along those lines. And oh God, I loved that he said that. So he just said, oh, this thrills me if the character does this, and then the next thrilling thing is this. And that's how it reads. Just this kind of thing that tumbles. It just tumbles over itself till it ends at the end and you go, it's like you've been holding your breath for those 100 pages.
Oof.
It's, yeah, that. I mean, that's to be in that space, to be able to, that's something I've taken on board is, okay, in the first drafts anyway, when you want to be a hero, is I'm going to write one thing after the other and then we'll worry about it later down the track. Because if I edit while I go, you don't get, I don't know, I don't get anything done. I don't know how you go if you're trying to edit as
I
you
can't.
Do it. Yeah, yeah. Right?
I can't edit as I go. Are you? In fact, I don't think I've ever been like that. I remember the very first play that I wrote, which was a stage play. I actually won an award for, and I didn't even edit it once.
Huh.
First draft knocked out, and that was it. I was like, "That's." I actually wrote it in a night because I was working on another play. It's a short play. It's like 12 minutes, 10 minutes long.
Mm.
And I was working on another play with a playwright in New Zealand. And it was super poetic and all this other sort of shit. And I just really wasn't all that interested. And lots of other people were, and they were just like, oh, this is going to be a really good play. The dialogue's there. And it was about typical one world, another world, one person falling in love, two people falling in love, completely different worlds.
Hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And I just wasn't in love with it. It was a shit script. I thought the dialogue was crap, but it was rubbish, really. And so the day that I was supposed to hand in the final draft, the night before, I sat up all night, and this is before I had final draft, on Word, just smashed out this 10-page, 11-page script from a clipping in the newspaper that I read about a diamond that sold in Antwerp for like 100-something million dollars.
Yeah.
And then wrote this play about these two bums on a bench seat just thumbing through the newspaper, asking for change, didn't mean anything. You know, just like, because I didn't want anything to mean anything. I just like, I'll just start with an article, start with, holy fuck, I can't believe this diamond in Antwerp sold for, and then boom, the dialogue started out. These two bums would just oppose each other the whole time and hate upon each other and tease each other, and people would come past that ask for cigarettes or coins or, you know, and then at the end of the play they would stand up and thank each other and say goodnight and punch out, and they'd have like a time clock and they'd punch out their time clock, and then two more business people would come in and change into bum clothes and sit down again, and that was a play. And it didn't really mean anything or say anything. And what was the question again?
Oh, I can't remember. No, it was, we're talking about just writing a thing and it happens and then it causes itself.
And oh, causes, yeah, itself. And so that was, oh, the edits. Yeah, so yeah. There was no edit on that at all. And I just, And for, oh, that's right. And then for ages, I was just like, that's what I do. I don't edit stuff. I just write stuff out and don't edit. And that is the failure, right? 101. Well, okay. It worked once. Doesn't mean it worked once. It's going to work again.
But it's in you. I kind of sense that in you because you're such a vigorous writer, if we call that. You go at it. I can see that energy survives that. Let's get this done, you know.
Yeah, but I think it's important to edit that. But again, going back, I think, to what we were talking with the earlier question, much earlier, about faults that people come across as they start out writing, is trying to get the perfect draft done.
Oh, yeah.
And like, that's not something that I've ever really aimed for, is aiming for that perfect first draft. But it's, for me, it's always about just getting it out. And that's why sometimes I write stuff that's a little bit on the nose to start with. I like pulling it back.
I think it's a good system. I'm trying to take some of that of what you do on myself, because that's always been my wall, is trying to make it perfect. And there's kind of an elegant self-sabotage in that.
Sure.
Because you can give up because it's not going perfectly. So I've got every right to stop this. And I've got, you know, several projects that got to page 40, 45 when it starts getting hard, because you've got to start addressing the promises you've made. And if it's not quite there yet, it's very easy to give up at the midpoint, saying, man, these characters make no sense. I don't know what comes next. This is nonsense.
Do you think that's another trap that people fall into when they start writing something, is not having a goal? Like, and I don't mean like as in saying something like political versus social, whatever, but having that, knowing where it starts and then vaguely knowing where you want it to go, not necessarily cementing that it's going to finish there, but at least having yourself a goal and where you want to finish it. Do you think if you don't have that, you just start writing, it's easy to fall into that 40 page halfway through the second act trap of what the fuck am I doing?
It's, where's for this me, going? Yeah, it definitely is, not having some sort of guide. I'm not very good at outlining or doing outlines, but they're useful for me, and then I can write them and then ignore them and go back to them when I'm lost and think, oh, okay, because yeah, like punching stuff out quick, it's great and it's chunky, but it does for me tend to get into trouble around the midpoint.
Sure.
When it's all set up, the setup's great because it causes itself. You know, you introduce the characters, here's what they're about, here's their world. Then something comes along and upsets the world, and now they're reacting to that. Now I'm stuck. They've reacted to it. Now what do we do? It's tricky. I'm with a company in Pro Melbourne. We do improvised theatre, and that's fun because that is literally first draft theatre. So it's chunky and it's in the moment, and it comes and it's gone. So that's pleasurable. But I was going to teach a term, a thing called play it like a playwright, where I just write the first four pages of a play, and then they do a cold read and improvise the rest. And let me tell you, that is liberating as a writer because it's just all set up. I just get to do those four pages.
And then
you guys figure out all the problems I usually run into. So that's fun. If I could be that free every four pages with the same kind of just abandon and, I'll have him do this, you know. If I could take that energy into every four pages in 120 pages, that'd be a nice place to be.
Yeah.
But I've never found a way. So if you know a way how to be free and go, I love writing, this is the best.
I reckon someone's done a hack on YouTube. You just pay $12.99 a month and they'll show you the secrets.
You should start success. That channel, man.
There's so many people out there that think they know the formula.
Well, there are formulas, and if they work, they don't. I just don't trust that they work for anyone all the time, and they definitely don't work for all the people because we're all different, you know.
That was actually something that I was pretty curious to ask you, is I think it's something that we've talked about before, but for example, when you're watching a movie and you love the movie and you're right into it, and then there's this flat spot in the movie you still enjoy but you're starting to switch off, is that a script thing?
Oh, good question. Probably. Maybe. Because you kind of think if the actors are doing the job, they're going to do the job in every scene, right?
Yeah.
And the, you know, the DOP or the other stuff, you'd think it'd be consistent, but it may be. But yeah, if I go back and analyze why I was bored, it's usually, because the scene was doing something that's already been done. So I was a bit bored, saying, I already know this. Or this is a 4-minute version of a 20-second idea.
Sure.
You know, that lovely time as a writer when you find a way to delete three pages because you did it in a gesture. Or you find it in a previous scene. Oh, if we just had this character light the cigar and smile then, we can lose that monologue. That's a nice that's a nice feeling to delete pages. But
it is.
Sometimes they they get up on the screen. Maybe it's just pacing, but it just feels superfluous.
Because there was something that we talked about a while ago where you were like, there is a formula to script writing where by a certain point, this needs to have happened. And if that happens by a certain point, this needs to have landed. And if that doesn't land, then people don't get the payoff that they've invested in. An investment, I mean, by paying to watch something or sitting, paying by time even, you know.
Or you're asking, and, you know, to get people out of their homes to go to the theatre or the movies today, it's quite a task because you've got Netflix. You know, I love the theatre and movies, but good luck getting me off my couch and YouTube. I've got a biscuit. I'm not going anywhere. But I go on board with that template. Like, there's the save the cat and there's the hero of a thousand faces. I think that stuff's true. And I think it's important to know it and understand why it works so you can break the rules with purpose.
What is that? What's the save the cat hero of the moment?
I think that breaks down like the act structures into explicit page numbers. So by page 25, this has to occur. And you know, the Dark Night of the Soul, I think it's got 14 steps of here are the classic story beats.
Sure.
And I find it useful for outlining, just to, it exposes holes. Like, oh, I don't know what that moment is. I may not have to know when I've done the script, but I should be aware that I don't know what that moment is. You know, the Dark Night of the Soul, my character's not having that. So does that matter? I don't know, but it's good to know. I think it's important. It's like the scales if you're learning piano, or, you know, the fingering on a guitar. I think it's important to know. Don't rely on just inspiration. You need to have technique.
Sure. And technique's not just grammar and spelling.
No, it's understanding stories and understanding why stories work and why the stories you like, why do they work for you beyond the emotion of it. How's the writer doing that? I mean, there'd be different people. I'm a very diagnostic person. I think that's why I'm a stronger story editor. I like pulling it apart and go, what's it doing? But I think it's important to know.
Let's use that then, and let's look at an example of a couple of films.
Mm-hmm.
And so look at The Godfather, right? Mm. The first Godfather that was done. Brilliant film. Yes?
Yes.
Second one, equally good.
Yep.
Different.
Mm.
And what happened in the third one?
Third one was Al Pacino trying to get out, and his daughter gets shot at the end. It's the third one is all right.
But why is it boring?
Okay. I just think Michael Corleone's story was done with Godfather 2.
Didn't need a third one?
No. Well, because even Godfather 2 doesn't really tell his story that much. It tells young Vito and how he comes about, and kind of the Godfather tells his story. It's that moment in the last shot when he closes the door on his family, on his wife, and goes, that's his story. He's done. We know what's going to happen to him now just by watching that first movie. So the fact that the third movie comes along and tries to tell this final act when he's trying to undo his story, it's like, we already know this. We know how it's going to end. So you can't possibly write that script that's going to be as good as the story in my head. I mean, it could have been. I mean, why wouldn't you go back to a fascinating character? It just felt like The Godfather 3 just felt like a story we didn't need to see. So they're up against it, I think. And, you know, it's all right. It's fine. It's kind of nice seeing those characters again, and you see him full of regret and rage, but he was full of his character already had that. It was already present in the first two stories. It's like, so that is kind of like a scene when I switched off. I switched off in that whole movie because it was superfluous to me personally.
You knew already.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I don't need to see this. I already know this about this character.
There wasn't any new information.
No.
Is that also, do you think that's also some of the problem with TV series and why they start out great, first couple season, two seasons, and then you get further along and that you just feel like the episodes are rehashing?
Yeah, I mean, I admire TV writers that there's, you know, shows that have been going 7-8 series and they're still strong. It's like, it's kind of magic to me that they can still find things to discover in these characters.
The Simpsons.
Yeah, right? Yeah, you know, the term jump the shark is you start seeing writers bring in extraordinary circumstances because they've run out of internal mechanisms to test in the characters. So they're going to have a meteor hit the apartment and then and they work as drama or melodrama for an episode or two, but the characters aren't showing you anything new because you already know these characters. So that writers can do that, and I don't think it's an accident that it takes a whole lot of them in a writer's room to be that good. and a really good showrunner who knows what the show is doing. But yeah, that's fascinating to me that people can actually sustain
a series
for that long and it still works. You know, oh, I'm still finding out this character. They're finding ways to keep me interested in what they're going to do.
I think about that with Wentworth Australia.
Ah.
It's you know, it's going ahead, more season, more episodes. Oh, and I think it's amazing what the writers can do on that show, and how I think it's true in saying that show actually gets better. It's getting better as it's going along. Mm. And I think it's amazing. I think I agree with you. I find it amazing that TV writers can keep people engaged in a series that's about the same thing. And how do they keep finding new ideas and new...
Yeah, it's the craft, I guess. I mean, what would you pick down as... I like the great TV shows, often around season 3, season 4, seems to be. They just, they know what it is and they're really running at stuff. What's your pick for the ones?
Game of Thrones, for sure.
Oh, okay.
I'm addicted. I think it's amazing. I love the risk and the bravery that they show, that the writers show.
What does that look like?
No fear. So they have no fear of setting an audience up and then letting them down.
Hmm.
But the delivery of letting them down doesn't necessarily mean that they're letting you down with a set off that they've like set up this whatever, this thing that you think is going to exist. And then they show you something completely else. So you've like, oh my God, I've disappointed that didn't happen, but holy fuck. Like the first season where they killed off their main character and Sean Bean, like the leading guy, boom, and he's dead. It's just like, no one does that.
It's a nice moment when you feel like just a fan when you're watching a TV show or a movie and like something happens and you just go, fuck.
Yeah.
What's going to happen now? It's like, that's a nice feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other one I think did really well. I think it did well to start with, and I think it fell into that trap of the fourth, fifth season blues, was The Wire.
Mm.
HBO's The Wire. Loved it, and then I feel like it was flogging. I honestly can't think of too many other shows that have gone past 5 seasons that have been able to sustain that. Neighbours. It's gone for it. Keeps going.
Obviously,
man.
Goes without saying.
But
I admire those. What good writing. What good writers they are. They can put them out.
It's hilarious.
Bang, bang,
it's
bang.
It's a funny show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like it. I don't mind it. I don't mind Neighbours. I think it's great. It's been very good to me over the years. And I don't know. I love it. I love them.
There's
love
a skill in that of just getting it done, of getting the melodrama down. I mean, like Woody Allen was forced early on to write jokes for a skit show, a comedy skit show up in the Catskills or something like that. Right. It was a holiday for rich people, and he was hired and he just had to write material. And in interviews with him, he's talking about how it just forced him to find a way to be funny because he had to produce an hour of material a night. So you just get it done. You just, something about that deadline, right? It activates us. It was some ridiculous amount. You go, you're not going to be able to be funny for that. You might write one or two ideas, but it's like, no, you're just forced to. You're forced to be obvious and inventive at the same time. You're forced to trust your ideas and see them through. I do like a deadline for that reason.
I love deadlines.
Yeah, so if you could...
An hour's a bit tight, though.
Yeah. Well, I think he had a day. It was something ridiculous like, oh, man, that'd be hard. And then you have to do it as soon as you're done. It's like the South Park guys. How they write it and shoot it in a week, is it?
South Park's another one. How do they sustain that? But I just think they keep hitting on social nerves, don't they?
I think it's their process must be is part of it, where they sit down, have the writers meeting, and a week later it's going to air. I think that's the turnaround. It's like, that's insane. And there's a documentary. Have you seen the documentary? They look so unhappy. It's like the first writers meeting. It's like you come away, you know, everyone just hates everything about everything. It's so depressed, but they get it done. They put themselves through that, and I think it shows. That deadline forces them to make choices.
What do you think? So have you seen Black Mirror?
A couple episodes only.
What do you think?
I like it. It didn't... Because it's episodic, I can drop in and out.
Yep.
Yeah.
Is that why you like it?
I don't know. I liked it. I wanted to see the one where they have things in their eyes, lenses, and they replay. They can store memories and replay, and that's terribly depressing.
That's a hard one, that one. That's too soon, I think.
Yeah. I've heard like people who I trust say you should watch it and love it because I loved The Twilight Zone back in the day. There's a show that I think for like season three through five, every episode was just like bang, bang, bang in a row. And of course, that's coming back. Jordan Peele is hosting that now. So it reminded me of that, kind of a modern version. But it made me sad as a human watching it. So
what
I have
do you
to,
mean?
I like that one where they have the memories and then it's just a difficult pleasure. That's what I'd put it. So I liked it, appreciate it, but I'm just going to watch one a month.
I remember watching one and then we were like, oh my God, that's amazing. We'll watch another one.
Yeah.
And then we're like too depressed to go to bed.
I know, right?
It's just like, I feel like.
It's pretty close to the bone.
But it's, so where I'm going with this is what kind of stories do you think people are gravitating to now as an audience and where do you think it's going and is there much of a change happening?
Geez, that's a big question. I think I wondered, like, the zombie thing's been big for a while, right? And is that played out? I don't know. The Walking Dead's still going. What was that about? Was that fear of the other? Like, this was that on the back of? I mean, no, I guess it pays not to be too simplistic, but is that on the back of September 11 and this fear of this unknown thing that's just going to keep coming at us and doesn't care about our values and our system? Is that where the whole love of the undead came from, or do these things just cycle regardless? And it just so happened that the first series about zombies was a hit, so everyone did zombies. You know, if the first series was about werewolves, would we be saying the same thing? But now, as I say that, no, I think there's something specific about, you know, these zombies. Shuffling dead that want to eat you. What's happening now? I don't know. That's a good question, right? Because if you knew, you'd write it. I think what we need is rom-coms that have songs in them. I'm a sucker for sentimental, bright, happy.
Sure.
I know. Is it the cop-out just to say a good story well told, good actors who know what they're doing, a good script, a good director, and after 100 minutes you go, oh, I'm glad I watched that. That was good. I think there is, I don't know, are we... I mean, there's the movies at the cinemas feel more tentpole. I don't know if that's true. You know, the Avengers and, you know, giant cities, robots punching other robots in the face, which I like.
It's exciting.
When I'm in the mood for robots punching lizards, yes, I want to go watch my robots punching lizards, man. But I wonder if that's more of an event thing now to get people out of the home. So where that's going, I don't know, because how big can you get? How many CGI planets can you crash into each other?
How many people are on the planet at the moment?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know. What do you reckon? Where's the wind blowing?
I don't think stories have changed.
Yeah, I agree with that.
My thoughts are that just that stories, I don't think, have changed. And I don't think the ways in which stories... I don't think the way in which a story is told is being changed. I think it's just how people access that story. And I still think that a good story is a good story. There's a that Shakespeare thing that people talk about. There's only actual seven stories in the world that exist, and you can't have any more than seven. There isn't any other type of story that exists in those seven stories. I can't remember what the hell they are, but I think there's truth in that. And I think if you look at all films or books or anything, they're just different characters in different places saying slightly different things, all doing slightly different things, but getting to the same point.
Yeah, I agree.
There's either like adversity, there's love, there's challenge, there's good versus evil, there's, you know, it's the grinding, it's the plateaus, it's the movement, it's the one thing changing to its evolution, it's one thing changing into another, you know. I don't think stories change.
Yeah, I'm with that. Often when I'm up in my head and I'm feeling a bit diagnostic, just watching something on Netflix, you know, I'll stop as I'm watching a scene and I think, given they literally could have written anything, why did they choose to have the guy walk into a convenience store and buy a Coke? And then say that to the guy in the red shirt. Why was it the guy in the red shirt? You know, you can think yourself into a corner here. But it's also so interesting. And why'd they put the camera there? It's like, and when stories are really well told, I think everyone knows. The writer knows exactly why that had to happen, because the scene was doing this. The director knew exactly where to put the camera. The actors knew exactly what was happening. The sound recorders, the mix, editing is serving that same story.
Sure.
And those, for me, when I think about the movies and the theatre I love, it just feels like something magical happened where everybody contributed to this thing that couldn't exist unless everybody contributed to it. The writer gave part of it, then the director gave part, but they all did their job. And you get this amazing piece of art at the end, which is like films for me, like the early ones in my childhood, Jaws. Jaws had an enormous impact on me just for the love of going to the movies, for one, sure. Being in the dark and having 1,000 people scream. But just for what a good fucking movie that is. You know, it's beautifully written. The acting is just, I think it's as good as acting as I've seen, that they know exactly how to do it and what to do it. And, you know, a young Spielberg, the editing, just everything about that movie. And if you can say, oh, the shark was fake, who cares? That's a perfect movie for me. I look at that and I'm still astonished by just how it propels itself along. And at the end, the shark blows up and we go, oh, I've been holding my breath for 2 hours. That kind of exhilaration.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, yeah, sorry, guys. Yeah, the shark loses.
Just in case, because you never know, man.
Well, that's a 44-year-old movie, oh so, God. You know.
What?
Yeah, 1975.
Get the fuck out of here.
I know, 44 years.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, don't think about it. If you go back 44 years before that, it's before World War II. That's how time works.
Fuck.
I know.
I heard a strange fact the other day that Cleopatra is closer to the iPhone release than she is to the pyramids being built.
That's amazing, isn't it? That stuff. It does your head in a good way. Yeah. Let's get a sense of exactly how 1,000 years can work. You go, oh, it's just a bunch of years all bundled up. Yeah.
It's humbling, isn't it?
It makes me want to go to the movies so I can forget that I'm going to die. Ironically, I need to sit in a dark room with light in my face to stop me from thinking about my own death.
Watching a fucking shark blow up.
Yeah, it's other people's problems.
Holy fucking crap. Yeah, it's a hell of a world, man.
Well, the act of writing surely is to leave something behind. It is for me.
Yeah.
I was here because I want to leave something behind. That's whatever it is, you know, there's probably a psychological term for that, why people have kids or the need to be a god. That's probably a little grandiose, but yeah, leave something behind. It's definitely part of why I can't not create, because otherwise I feel like I probably feel invisible to myself. I'm not leaving anything behind.
So that's important?
It feels important to me, yeah. Again, it can trap me because it's quite a grave thing. I must leave something behind. But it's beneath the drive why I have to do it, even though I hate it, because not doing it feels worse.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, right?
Yeah. So where, because you came, you studied late, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to uni in my 41st year. I turned 40 in my first year at uni. I loved it. It was such a good experience. Change, that was a game changer for me for just what I went from working full time and having money to now having much less money, but trading that for meaning, and it was a good choice.
Well, I say to a lot of people, you can spend money and get it back, but you can never spend time and get it back.
It feels like it's important to feel that way if you're gonna create stuff.
Sure.
Because time is what you spend.
Yeah, it is.
That's the only stuff that's free for you. I mean, you know, if you watch a movie, like it's a $40 million movie, and you think, you know, that script was about $1.80 worth of pages. Couldn't you spend another month on it and save yourself $40 million? Obviously, it's not that simple, I get. But it's like, you know, you're doing all these $20 million reshoots.
Yeah, yeah.
You could have spent an afternoon there and fixed that.
Surely.
You could have fixed that. But I guess it's a different way of their writing product necessarily. Let's get that thing in the movies.
Well, going back to those tent pole films that you're talking about, there's less and less dialogue in them than there used to be. There's more and more action. More showing, yeah.
Intuitively, it makes sense. I just come out of that. What's the last one? Endgame. I won't do any spoilers.
I haven't seen it yet as well.
There's a purple guy and there's guys in capes. That's all I'll let you know. I mean, it's good. It's good. It's like you go, oh, I'm glad I saw that. That's what I needed.
Yeah.
I needed a $500 million movie to have stuff happen, and it does. Yeah, but less dialogue. Yeah, it's probably true. And I think I liked most about that film is it actually is spend some time in the intimacy of just two people in a room talking stuff. It's like, that's nice. It still works. No matter what the movie is, I think you're right. You know, even if it's a Pixar thing about an animated lizard who's friends with a crane, it's us. We're watching. We're looking for, basically, I think I am. I'm looking for a version of two people in a room trying to sort stuff out. trying to figure out how do we do this? How do we? And I think plays get to that because of their restrictions. It's often, you know, five people in a room on a particular night. Yeah. They're my favorite sort of theater at all. Definitely Jerusalem, I talked about. It takes place almost in real time in this mm-hmm. one enclosed situation. So that 2 hours in the theater as an audience is kind of 2 hours in the actors in the play's life, but everything's changed by the end. It's like, oh, the world's upside down. Oh. And then you come out of the theater or the movies, especially like going during the day. So when I come out and I'm shocked that it's still daylight and that the world's still noisy and trams are still rattling along, it's like, how can you still be here? Yeah, don't you know what I just experienced?
I've gone through a transition. Yeah, you should have all changed by now, but the sun's still up. You
like a little version of coming back from a great holiday. You can't believe everything's still the same, but I feel different.
I feel like the world pauses when you go to see a movie during the day and you come out.
It's my favorite thing.
Really?
That's the thing I'd be most unhappy having to give up, is just popping down the Lido when I've got a day off in the morning, seeing a movie I want to see. I don't think I'm more happier than that 3 hours. It just makes me feel like I'm eight again going to see Jaws. That same, you know, never lost that feeling of when the screen goes dark, the studio logo comes up, you get that first hint of music, that same thrill of really that optimism. This is going to be another movie that changes me. Rarely is. You know, most movies, they're good. That was good. But always going in, I'm hoping this is another movie that changes me the way Jaws changed me back in the day, and then maybe Raiders of the Lost Ark and Mad Max 2 when I was a teenager.
I think, though, that's a good series. That's a good the Indiana Jones series. Holy shit. Those scripts are amazing. They're funny. They're engaging.
They're clean. They get it done, right?
To the point.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean by clean?
Yeah. It's like it knows what it is and it does what it does, and it doesn't make apologies. It just gets on with it. It kind of, you know, these things that feel like they cause themselves. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones actually says in Raiders of the Lost Ark, I don't know, I'm making this up as I go along. It's like, yeah, aren't we all? What are the ones that changed you, like the movies or the books?
Books are a funny thing for me. I love reading books, but I okay, so definitely, it was definitely a book for me that I think changed some stuff, and it was reading Post Office by Charles Bukowski.
Oh, okay.
And have you read Charles Bukowski?
Poems here and there.
I've got a book upstairs, I'll give you. He's cult classic. There's a reason for it. He's just a brutal writer, and he's very easy to read. He's like, there's no fluff shit. It's just like sentence full stop.
It's just, does that start with this is a book written by no one important, dedicated to no one, or something like that?
So the story with Charles is that his editor or his publisher, that's what it was, his publisher knew Charles, because Charles Bukowski would write short stories for porn magazines and for newspapers and cartoon clippings and all that sort of shit.
That was a living, you know.
And he actually worked at a post office. And then his publisher said, I'm going to pay you $100 a month for the rest of your life to leave so you can write full time.
Hmm.
And back then, $100 a month was probably like just enough to live.
Hmm.
Now it's not fuck all, really.
$100 a
month. Yeah, it's like, I think it's just above the poverty line.
I spend that on coffee, man.
$1.60 a day or some shit. But so he agreed to that. And then 3 weeks later, he had his first novel.
Wow.
He'd done it, which is Post Office. And it's a phenomenal book. And I think the thing that it did for me was, you can write like that and be successful. You don't have to be some bachelor, university degree, Nobel, Duke or Earl, or, you know, you don't have to be this incredibly gifted, well-versed person that's has everything down perfect. You know what I mean? It can be rough, it can be raw, and it can be that. And that for me changed. That for me felt like doors and things were accessible then. It felt like because that is me. I am rough and I'm raw in how I do things. And I think the podcast is a great example. Hit record and go.
Yeah, that's true, right?
It's raw, you know. But I liked that. I liked that it was like, you can do that. You can, you know, that's okay. You don't have to be, things don't have to be perfect, and things don't have to, because I always did things and felt like they weren't, oh, maybe it's, you know, Is it good enough? Is what you're doing good? Or am I worthy, you know, of doing this? And he was just the guy who was like, I don't really give a fuck. I'm just going to do it.
It's nice, isn't it? I think I was mapped in a similar way with Charlotte's Web.
Right on.
Is that I'm activated something that I am, which I'm quite sentimental. And I like having a bit of a cry and a bit of, oh, they did it. You know, transcendental narratives, or, you know, even survival narratives where they make it. But it's that, those early books that map us and put that voice in us, or I think perhaps allow us voice that we already have to come to the fore. And that's a lifelong thing. You know, it's hard to trust that you're being authentic. I'm never sure when I am or aren't, especially when writing. I think I'm always mimicking someone in some way. Often the last thing I've read, if I sit down and read a whole bunch of Chekhov, I'm going to do my best. I'll be mimicking him. And maybe that's okay. Maybe that's authentically me, is I'm a bit of a mimic. I take other people's, that story, that's a spirit of me. I take other people's ideas and I rearrange them into something in my voice.
Yep.
That's kind of me. That's taken me a long time to be comfortable with, and I'm still mostly comfortable because, you know, it's hard to let go of the romance of I'm a writer. I still have a hard time telling people that. So what do you do? I say, I write, I'll say, ah, right. And I do other stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Or I'll say, I'm a theatre maker.
It's like, all right.
Theatre maker.
I make theatre.
I make theatre, you know, for the, it's like, yeah, it's hard. It's, yeah, I find that hard. It stops in my mouth like I don't have the right.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, because I haven't made the perfect book that's changed the world. And I haven't won my Pulitzer or whatever I haven't been on Time magazine or, I don't know. Probably because I can't say it to myself in the mirror. That's probably the truth of it. I look and say, Tim, you're a writer. And then I'll giggle and go, well, but I do other stuff. I'm also a theatre maker. You know? I don't know. How do you go with that confidence? Does it matter? Do you have to be able to say that? I don't know.
I say to people that I'm an actor. Actor-writer is what I say.
Yep.
It took me a long time. I don't know why. Again, I think it's that thing of accessibility. I think it's that thing of you're allowed to do this.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Like,
what does that mean? Allowed. That's an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. I really think that. I think that people struggle with allowing themselves to be that thing, or to, you know, because they feel like they can't, because they feel like the world won't let them.
Yeah. Isn't that an interesting place to be in? It's like...
And it goes so... I know so many people that are actors or writers, and that it's like... And it's a very common thread story that people talk about, is that it's not a real job, or, you know, it's that shame thing of saying, I told my parents that I wanted to be an actor or a writer or, you know, a circus performer, and they were like, that's not real, you know. Maybe you should get a backup job. So, as if saying it, as if it's going to fail. But what's the failure? And that's the thing that I resorted to as well, is that I had this moment where I was, I have no backup skills. I'm not a doctor.
Not a doctor? Could be. No. You can act as if you're a doctor. Right. Isn't this just what doctors do?
But I, the whole thing of a backup, right, this whole idea of a backup job assumes failure. Assumes that something can go wrong. But I have this thing where I say that the failing is not persisting. The failing is letting go. And then you've got to ask yourself, what is it that you're trying to succeed in? What is it that you're trying to achieve, you know? And why is that the goal, rather than just being in it?
What does success look like for you?
Yeah.
What is it? Is there a...
Well, like, success is living. Success is, for me, success is just continuing the fight. Is oh God, it sounds so fucking...
We're doubting ourselves. We're saying, you know, it's about freedom. Well, is it?
it's about following the thing that I enjoy doing.
Yeah.
So for me, that changes. So I'm not always just an actor. I'm not always just a writer. It's like I find various things interesting. And so I pursue those. And so for me, the success is knowing that I've done what I've loved throughout my life, and that changes, you know. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with things changing. And my, I don't really have like a solid career of one particular, you know, vase of flowers. I don't have that. That's what that looks like. I don't have that. I have a variety of things that I like doing, and
I'm okay with it. I'm okay with how it is at the moment. And I've already achieved a shitload more than I ever thought that I ever would.
Made a feature film, man.
Well, I've been on TV. I've had articles written up. I've got newspaper clippings. My mother sent me a Weet-Bix card with me on it.
Oh, get out. How'd you score that?
What the fuck is that? Lord of the Rings.
How's that not framed in this apartment we're in?
What's going on? It is framed, nothing. You know, photo of me and Emma. So I've already succeeded past, you know, I've gone way past where I ever thought. With what I grew up with, you know, thinking of what people can do, you know what I mean? I just didn't really... Growing up, I saw people on TV or the different people.
Yeah.
They're not, you know what I mean? It's like, it's this fabric.
Yeah, I get that.
And so success to me is like knowing that that isn't a fabric. Success to me is knowing that your life is your life and that as long as you're happy doing what you're doing, even if you're not happy, it's okay. It's like, you know, you will live and then one day you won't.
Oh my God.
It's fatalistic, isn't it?
But, well, it's true.
But that's a fact. So it's like, I don't know, like just things change and your life changes as you go through it. So success to me isn't just like nailing one particular thing or having an award or, you know, it's just doing what I love doing. And it's just various, sometimes nefarious activities.
Do you find in those various things you're doing that there is an idea or a thing that's trying to find its way out in different
it's
ways?
It's just stories, man. It's just telling stories.
What stories do you find yourself drawn to then to tell?
Changing. From time to time, it changes.
Okay.
Like initially it started out just being stories that were engaging and entertaining. Didn't matter what it was about.
Mm.
It didn't really have to have a meaning or about. It was just can you keep people sustained in a seat for however long?
Which is quite a trick itself. You're going to be in a seat for 2 hours and I'm going to try not let you get bored.
I always thought about that with theatre. Whenever I did a theatre show, I didn't want the show going longer than an hour.
Really?
I just felt like an hour was too long for people, like anything more than that and people would start shuffling.
I think there is like a pathology as well to there's only so long we can listen for. That's why probably theatre has intervals, right? That's like at an hour 20, they let us out for 15 to reset so we can listen again. An hour. It's the magic. You're onto something there. You should write a self-help book.
60
minutes of theatre or less. And that's all you can do.
I don't know. Get these little fucking pop-ups.
Here's a question. What do you fear most? I mean, you're talking about as a writer that someone would say, oh, you haven't really changed anything. But if you finished a project and it's up there on the screen, what reaction do you fear most in the audience?
That's a shit question, man.
You're welcome.
I don't know.
What do you most want? Actually, let's start with the positive. What's the reaction you most want?
The suspended.
Yep.
Suspended disbelief. You know, the people don't feel like they've watched something. They've just been through something.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll go with that.
You know? Mm. And then the pole of that is the opposite. You know what I mean? Like, well, what's the worst fear? That people are breaking stuff down too much. Actually the worst thing, you know. Actually, I used to have this thing. I don't care if someone's walked out or if someone's stayed. I've elected a feeling.
Yep.
You know, like I've made someone feel something positive or negative. I'm walking out. I fucking hated that. Cool.
Yeah, hey, I'll go with that.
You know, versus...
I'd rather they stay, but if they walk out, well, that happened. That's a thing.
Well, that happened. And like, holy fuck, I can't believe that. Just, you know, I mean... You don't really want that.
No.
It's not something you want, but at least you've made them feel something, I guess. It's a negative. I don't know. Is that something that you...
I'm chasing the feeling I got from those first movies. It's exhilaration to be, I think, similar to what you're saying, to feel like I've been taken somewhere.
Sure.
And at the end, I've been dropped, and I'm going, what the fuck was that? That's all the theatre and movies I love. Give me that experience. It's why I go to the movies. It's why I go to the theater. I want to be transported and forget I'm me. And when I get back into the daylight, I'm going, oh, what? You know, I want to be messed around. I want to be traumatized.
Sure.
So that's something, I'd like whatever I make, I want to give the reader or the person who watches that experience that they got transported somewhere. And at the end, they didn't realize they'd been holding their breath for 2 hours. and welcome back to the world. Goodbye.
Sure.
Go sort out your life. But to give them that, yeah, that's what I loved as a kid and still love now. So that's the thing I want to create.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That feeling of this, the suspension of disbelief and being transported.
Excitement, anticipation, and then at the end it's like, whoa. And that people are glad and excited that they experienced that.
Yeah, yeah.
It gave them something. It did something to them.
Do you find you get that, because you, with the improv stuff that you do, do you find that you get good hits with that, that people tend to?
Yeah, it's the funny thing with improv is you get a lot of that hit for a little work. And there'll be people who are improvisers who probably will disagree with that.
What do you mean?
You can get a laugh pretty easily in improv, and a laugh is a kind of a hit. You don't even have to be particularly that funny. To get something more than that. Lately, I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm craving scripted work. I'm craving creating artifacts beyond a show that kind of exists in the moment and then is gone. Because I think I want something deeper, more of a dialogue. It's a good question, but with improv, definitely you get hits because if you're doing it well. Or any theatre, really. Any live performance is in the moment.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if it's scripted or not. It's in the moment. We're all breathing this together. Improv has that as its kind of conceit. So when it's done well, it still feels as good as it ever has the first time I did it. It's like we're all breathing in this together, and actually the audience is complicit in the story. They're helping you tell it. As strange as that may sound, you're actually reading them and you're sensing what they want and playing with them, and you're in the moment with another actor. It's a great feeling. You just, like, it's happening.
Clicks, doesn't it?
Yeah. Just flow state, whatever that thing is. Like, there's something that no single person here could create, but all of us together, we're creating this and we're sort of aware of it. So that stuff is great. But
you're getting immediate feedback while you're creating it as well.
You're feeling it as you're making it, and then it's gone, and it's kind of the point. That takes work for me. I'm not particularly talented, so it takes a lot of technical work, a lot of practice, knowing your scales, knowing how to listen. Because you've got to be a good improviser, you've got to listen like a therapist. You've got to listen to what the person says. You've got to listen to why you think, how they said it, everything. You're watching them, like, everything they do. But that's me. You don't have to go into it that deep to get a hit. You can step on stage and make a joke and get a laugh and get the hit if that's what you want. Good luck to you. But you and I will not be sharing a stage. I'm too old. I'm too old for short. I've just done it too long to do short form comedy. It just feels like versions of the same thing.
Sure.
So no one wants to be on stage with me if I'm bringing that and they're having fun. But definitely when it works, when you've really created something in the moment, it has meaning and we all feel something, it's a great feeling.
So what are you working on at the moment with the improv stuff? Because I remember a while ago you were talking about, because I have no idea how the improv world of theatre works. Mm. Because for me, it's theatre and it's stand-up. And I feel like improv is an amalgamation of the both.
Yep.
Because stand-up's another thing. It's so regimented. And it's a lot of work goes into stand-up, like theatre does. And then improv is just so transparent. It's just so thin the glass. You know what I mean? There's no... So what is it that... Because I remember one day you were talking about... Yeah, the song thing where people would like... put it on and you had to sing the idea.
That's a show our company does called Smells Like a Song. The basic conceit is you and I are doing a scene. Let's say we're at a bar, whatever, we're just chatting along, and then one of us says a line of dialogue. If the audience calls Smells Like a Song, that's the song. That line of dialogue is the cause of that moment. So you've got to trust that you're already doing something, otherwise what are you singing about? And it kind of, what I like about that, and musicals, improvised musicals are my favorite, because it's about slowing down the moment and going deeper into what is here in the song. And that's what songs give us. Also, you know, soliloquies give us that. Let's slow down and go deeper into what's already here and find out what this is really about. So when we come out, we've had that little 2 minutes of transformation. Now we're back in the world and everything's changed. That's my favorite type of improv. That's that.
Really?
Yeah, musical improv, because you got to be in the moment. If you're not in the moment, you're dead. So that kind of standard, like, I've got to be here and just trust. Okay, we're talking, we're at a bar, you've said, oh, I've got news, Billy. Smells like a song. Where you go, you better have news. But you've got to slow down and trust. Well, where am I? And I'm going to open my mouth, I'm going to start singing something, and I'll trust that that'll cause the next line, then that'll cause the next line, and then I'll get to the chorus and I'll know, here's what I'm saying, you know. And then there's rhyme and melody and all the other, but that's the technical stuff. You got to practice that stuff so you don't have to think about it. like anything, right?
Yeah.
When you're surfing, practice so you're not thinking, where's my weight? What's the angle of that wave? You just do it. That
surfing is the worst sport to practice as well.
It's called surfing. Practicing surfing is just called surfing, man.
You have to wait, and then the conditions have to be right, and you have to have time to go as well. And, and whenever you've got time to go, the conditions are never right. It's just so shit. It's so fucked. Bring on the wave pool, fuck. Oh,
that's like improv in general. You can do anything, and it is done. Like, you know, you're talking about Bukowski. If we would sit down and say, let's do some improvised Bukowski, if we know it and we love it, I think it's important to love the genre or the style you're doing.
Sure.
Otherwise, you mimic it. We could do that. We know the characters of the world and the sort of, and let's say we ask the audience, okay, we're going to do a 20-minute two-handed Bukowski scene. We're at a bar, you know, and we just ask something simple. It's like one of our characters had big news today. It's your daughter's birthday. Away we go. 20 minutes later, we've created a piece of theatre. And if we're good and we're listening to each other, and if we know what Bukowski's about, or we know what that world's about, then we'll go places no single writer could go.
Do you feel like you have to give yourselves frameworks to work within? Otherwise, it's too open?
Limitations. It's the paradox, right? Yeah, definitely. That's often why, almost always, I think we ask for an ask for. We just want one limitation or one thing. Park bench. Cool. That already brings assumptions, something to spark the imagination. To start from nothing, oh, that's terrifying.
It's hard, isn't it? When people say, oh, free roam, you know, create anything you want. You're like,
yeah. It's like, oh, create, I want you to write me a horror script, 5 pages, and it involves a 16-year-old boy.
Okay.
Go. At least that, for me, that's again, it's that story editor impulse.
Yep.
I can react to that. It's like, okay, I'm going to move stuff around. Give me, go write a masterpiece. It's like, oh, I want to die. Give me something.
Give me something.
I want to react to something. Yeah. And it's to trust to react to my own words. Yeah, that's a work in progress.
So what came first for you, the improv or the script writing?
Writing first. Did a bit of dabbling and a bit of filmmaking in my 30s. And then that all fell on a heap. It was just too hard. Then I went to improv, and that was kind of, that's been my kind of the thing that helps me feel creative.
Sure.
If I'm not producing pages or other stuff outside, I'm at least turning up to the theatre and we're having a go at something.
Yeah.
Though lately, like it's what I get from it. I need to go deeper faster or I don't get the hit.
What do you mean?
I need to do work that has meaning, beauty and meaning attached to it. It doesn't mean it can't be silly. It just needs to be, we're doing something. What is this scene doing? We're a couple of adults bringing ourselves to the work and figuring out whatever, if it's a improvised musical, improvised Shakespeare, even short form comedy. I need to feel like I'm bringing myself to the work and bringing myself to my scene partner, and we're seeing each other and hopping to it. And it's, I guess that sounds kind of vague, but I just don't get the hit from flimsy work. About, you know, a couple of crazy characters, you know, hey.
Gastro jokes.
Yeah, I mean, that can be fine. It can be fine, but I need to feel there's something else going on
here. Some substance?
Yeah, substance is a good word. There's something beyond what we're doing. The text is just the thing that's allowing us to get to what we want to do.
Is the substance the framework for you?
Oh, what's that mean? That's interesting.
So is the guidelines that you've, the parameters that you've given the improv, is that... So let's improv about Billy sitting on a park bench, but he's troubled by depression.
Cool.
Is that the framework? Is that what you mean? The substance? So the substance creates the framework upon which you work?
Yeah, that's the spark. Like Bill, we know we're doing, let's say we're doing a show about mental health.
Yeah.
And we know playing a character called Billy, 16, is on a park bench and the mental health is assumed. That's enough. I could spark from that. So it gives me one idea. It gives me my first sentence as a writer. My job's just to write that first. In the moment, I just author that first sentence through an action or something, then trust that that's going to give me my second sentence. Mm-hmm. And then trust that'll give me my third. And if I trust that by about the fourth or fifth beat, it's bulletproof. It's just creating itself like good stories do, right? They cause themselves. A lot of the time in improv, as in writing, it gets a bit bumpy. We make choices that are not quite created. They're a bit forced. I have problems at my page 40 of long form. That's about a minute and a half in an improv scene. It starts wandering. The audience starts getting bored. The players start getting panicked.
Why is that?
So they've not honoured their promises. they're not paid real, or for me, when it goes wrong for me, I haven't paid attention to what I've created. I'm thinking about an idea I've got, or I've disconnected from my partner. I'm thinking about something clever I might say, or this genius movement. Okay. I haven't paid attention to that. We've just had a minute and a half of Billy on a park bench talking to a pigeon.
The wave. You're thinking too far ahead.
That's it. Exactly. And I'm not present. It all dies. So that's what I love about improv. You have to be present or it doesn't work. Not really.
Do you get a lot of... Because I say to a lot of actors that are struggling with working on scripts or finding characters or just being present in scenes, don't worry about the script, just do improv. Do you think that that's reasonable advice?
Yeah, I think it's a great tool. Like any tip, if it works, it works. But I...
mow the lawn and...
It might work one day, not other. It might work for a certain scene, the people in the room, but definitely it's something I'll go to as a first point to tip. Yep. If this scene is just tight and it's we can't find it on the page, for me, let's just put it on the floor and just see it. And it may not give you anything, but even just being distracted by something on the floor.
Because I feel like for me, one of the it's like I look at improv like comedy and I feel like people have the wrong idea about it. I think that people have the wrong idea about comedy, for example, because they look at comedy, and when you see actors take on comedy, they just go all loose and crazy. But good comedy isn't being loose and crazy. Comedy's discipline. Because there's set up, punch, deliver,
tension and release,
right?
Yeah.
And if you don't have control of what you're doing, and you're a little bit involuntary in what you're doing, the comedy just gets lost, and people, it's just a bit vague, and people's like, oh, I don't really know where I'm, because they haven't established one internal frameworks of themselves, like what they're trying to say and what they're trying to make funny. There's no framework that they're working within, and then the overall thing, there's no framework, there's no base. So if there's nothing like that existing, they're just two actors or three or four actors or one actor just being silly, and it gets boring very quick. And I think about that with improv as well, is that it takes a level of skill and discipline. It's not just about being silly and just saying random and doing random things. It's about discipline and framework and guidelines and hard work, as you put it.
I think so. Yeah, it's less hard work than other forms because you're in front of an audience and they clap you and you go, yay, I did it. But if I'm writing a first draft, not to get too haughty about it, but I'm improvising. Improvising is the act of creation, right?
Yep.
That idea wasn't there. Now it's here.
Yep.
We're improvising. First drafts, if I can bring the spirit forward of what it feels like to be in a really good moment in improv, that's a good place to write from. But mostly as a performer, I need another performer to get there. I need that hit with someone else on stage to get me to that place. And you're all alone on the keyboard. It's just a true thing. It's harder because I'm not hitting off everyone, but off any particular person. But it's nice when you sit, like when we have our meetings, get stuff done just talking it through. You just need to say it and hear yourself say it. It may not even be about the person's reaction. You just need to hear yourself describe your idea.
That's what you say to me all the time. Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, God, whenever we have a meeting. No. Because usually, they're so valuable and so important that sometimes it is that. Because I could be, for example, if I'm working on a script or a specific scene and I'm having a shitload of hard time getting through it and I just can't get to the point, sometimes I'll get up, I'll walk around, I'll say it to myself, or sometimes I literally just act out the fucking scene. I'm like, what is this person doing right now? And just try really hard to like get into their mind. And then other times there's something about having another person to do that too, that just improves that mode, that I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And it's just, as you said, sometimes just having someone else there to listen to it, not so much as to go, oh, don't do that, just try doing that, but to force you to think about what you're doing.
It's that'd be it. Like, there's advice for writers young and old is have someone you trust. They don't even have to be technically, don't have to have great opinions, whatever that means. Have someone you trust so you can just talk to them sometimes.
Yeah.
I've had that in partners who have no interest in being writers or story editors, but they can tell me when my stuff's boring because they're the people who are going to be reading my gear, right?
That's right. I often say to people that the only people that really understand what makes a good story is the person that reads it.
Mm.
So you can, there's so many, you know, I mean, there, yes, there is like masterclass professionals out there that, that know how to break down.
Also important, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you're not writing a story for them. You're writing a story for the audience that doesn't understand those things that are, but they know that if they pick up a book or read, or, you know, a poem or watch a film, like, that's either a good film or a shit film.
Mm.
They don't, maybe they don't know why, but they still do, and they still are, because that person wasn't very engaging. They're generally unstudied people, or just regular audience people, are generally very, very good judges of where something's going,
yeah,
and generally what's missing as well.
It's I mean, we both talked about, we want to transport the audience. Well, who's our audience? It's everyday people. We want to, yep, transport them into something wonderful. And I don't know if you find this, like, just the act of, like, when you watched sorry, what was the title of your post-apocalyptic movie? Severance.
Oh, Life on Earth.
Yeah. Life on Earth, Severance. Is it different when there's an audience watching it with you? Suddenly you see it with different eyes? Did you have that experience?
Oh, that's good. That's a good question. No, I'm still... like, I'd watched it so many times.
Yeah, there's that as well.
But and then we'd watched it a couple of times and needed to change a couple of things. It was nice to watch the film and not have to change anything.
Ah, okay,
so
that's good.
It was kind of relaxing, you know, because, like, right, we'd done it, we'd done everything that we'd, you know, and we'd gotten to the point where it's like, you've, at some point you've got to let go. At some point, yeah, you've got to...
Well, when do you know when that point is? I guess with a movie, when it's done and released, right? That's it.
Well, people change, you get director's cuts all the time, don't,
yeah,
you? You know, I don't know. I at some point, that was actually something else that I was quite good at. I was good at just letting go.
Hmm.
And going, okay, you know, you've worked on it enough, time to let it go. And is that something that you think about a lot as well with scripts? At some point, one, it's not going to work and you got to put that script to bed.
Yes.
or do you know what I mean? Or it's, when is the script done for you?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, you just got to trust it's done enough, so that'll do. Let it go.
Because you can always, you can keep writing.
Yeah, you could, but who wants to do that? I want to finish the fucking thing.
Oh, fucking drink.
Yeah. Oh, you know what I need to do? There's another 10 drafts. Yeah, that's going to be fun. But I always find it's like the act of handing it to someone else changes my attitude towards it. Suddenly I'm seeing it with different eyes, just that, sure, act of handing it. So that changes how I viewed it. But I don't know, hold on tightly, let go lightly. It's, I don't know, you know, when's it done? When it's done. How's that for genius advice? You'll feel it. You'll trust, I think, other ideas start coming, or you're just bored of it. It's like, it's done. Or that's it. We've, yeah, done, we've made all our choices. I haven't got any more choices in me. Or I trust that if I fiddle around with this, I'm just doing a different version of the same thing.
So you're just refining.
Yeah, it's done. I could spend, I could spend 10 months refining it, and it's just going to be a 10-month older story.
What's the difference between refining something and fiddling around with something too long?
Oh, it could be the same thing, I guess. Oh, I don't know. That's where I need help. I need someone else to, yeah, go, you're just fucking it up now. You're just moving stuff around because, yeah, you don't want to let it go, or you're worried it's not good enough.
Just bruising the story.
It's done. The car is built. Drive it, you know.
Oh, that'll be someone. Hang on.
Oh, I want it.
All right. Get my... I got a down jacket.
This is like an unboxing, an unboxing podcast. Oh. So he's biting in it with his incisors, opening the Kathmandu. It's a pleasant plastic sound.
Oh, I got sent a Granger's downwash kit from Kathmandu.
Oh, what's downwash?
So that's, down, dirty. My down jacket, because it's getting a bit dirty.
What are these little green balls?
So they help when you put the down jacket, because you got to, apparently you can wash down jackets, down sleeping bags and stuff with feathers in it.
Oh, like feather down. Sorry. Yeah, yeah. Okay, I got it. Yeah.
And mine was getting a bit rough, so I bought a down wash kit.
Huh.
Because you can't wash down jackets with, yeah, normal detergent, because it breaks down the waterproofing inside the feathers.
Oh, okay.
So you buy some proper shit, whatever the fuck this is, with an Granger's impossibly difficult lid.
Downwash.
And then you have to dry it. You have to let it air dry. But because the feathers clump together, you have to tumble dry it on a low setting. And then you put these stupid stressful things in with it. And then they fluff the jacket up so that they unclump the feathers and fluff the jacket in.
Ah, there's so science for you.
So thank you, Kathmandu.
Boom.
Yeah.
It's like you'd never look at that and say, I know what this is, these three plastic balls and that can of looks like aerosol.
Doesn't it? Looks like deodorant or aerosol.
I'd go, I don't know what that is. That's some executive stress kit.
Fucking open it. Oh, that's a challenge for one day. Oh, it's a screw top.
That's why we're the great apes, mate. That's why we rule the world.
Fucking knob.
Because we can invent and build those things and then not know how to use them.
That fucked me actually when Bear started having the pop considered the twist caps came out.
Yeah.
And the what fuck, and then they had like, oh my god, so they're trying to fucking just twist it, bro.
What's going on with the world?
Best invention though, screw top beer. What the fuck? Just put a bloody thread on it, man. Crazy. Presents.
Always exciting, yeah, getting a parcel, and it's like, oh, I'm like a millionaire.
Granger's downwash. For all your down articles.
Mm.
Artifacts. Mm. That's what my jacket is now, is a fucking artifact.
Alright.
Yeah. I was gonna ask you as well, when it comes to writing and acting and character work,
mm-hmm.
do you feel like you need to have a certain amount of that character in you to write it truthfully?
Yes. Yes. But there's write what you know, but also write what fascinates you.
Sure.
But I think what fascinates you is you want to know about it, so you sort of already... You at least know why you want to know about it. Does that make sense? So, yes. There we go. That's because I put it in some, you know, strict method. But, yeah, if I'm fascinated by the story that's in the character, mm-hmm. then I want to know. But it's because I already kind of have a feeling that I do know what they want to say, that confidence.
Sure.
I think it's important. It's important to, I don't know, write your truth, all the different ways you say it, but... I love write what fascinates you. I think it's a good place. What do you want to know about? What can't you stop thinking about? Well, write about that because you're clearly
thinking about it.
You let's get it out. It's write in the worlds, which, you know, the really good sci-fi writers and all that. They're in their world. They know what they're doing. Stephen King, how prolific is he? They just keep churning out good stories. They don't stop being fascinated by what they're writing about, I guess.
What's fascinating you right now?
Survival narratives have come back and it interests me. How does a character is put under pressure, an extreme event, usually they're, you know, bodily in danger. Not only how do they survive, but why go on? I like stories where characters are at the end of their tether and have to find a way to retain their dignity or find their because, like The Exorcist is. Redemption narratives, I guess. Survival and redemption narratives. They're the same thing, just one survival of the soul.
The Revenant.
Yeah, that's a very embodied one. Like that inch by inch struggle. Why? Why? That interests me. Yeah. Redemption narratives especially. It's always been what I've kind of written. I'm trying to sort out my own past, I guess. But it's, yeah, why try? Why is this character fighting this? Why don't they just give up? Well, because they can't. Because if they give up, it's worse than it's. If they give up, then what are they going to do?
Yeah,
that interests me. The stories I love and various forms is like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Although it's, you know, it's not a survival narrative. For me, it kind of is.
How so?
Why are we going to love each other? Why do this? It's going to end in hell. Why do we do this? You know, we know all these terrible things about each other. We have facts that we're going to hurt each other. Well, what else are you going to do? That. Something about that is beautiful and just interests me. Is like, well, yeah, because they have to. They haven't got a choice. They're going to love each other because what else are they going to do? And they're going to go back into this mess and they're going to bruise each other again and they're going to go through it all again and ask the same questions and hate each other. But what else are you going to do? You're going to take another step. Why? And for that movie, which I love, it's because we as people, we have to love. We have to. It's our meaning is... putting something more important than us allows us to actually see ourselves. So that's that kind of thing. You know, broadly, I'd call it a survival narrative or a redemption narrative. The things that fascinate me. Charlotte's Web. What is that? It's a redemption narrative. The pig learns to have self-esteem. Watership Down, same. All the art that mapped me, I think even Jaws in its way, the Chief Brody learns to be a hero. It's not explicitly what it's about, but they're the bits that survive for me. I think it's just that early art that got me at a time when I needed to hear those stories. I got some really good versions of it, so now they're the stories I want to tell.
Yeah,
it's just that it's in me. What am I going to do but not do my own redemption narrative, try to understand my past by writing stuff about characters who are lost. They don't know what they're doing, but now they've got one last chance to figure it out.
Yeah,
here you go. You can still save yourself. What are you going to do? You're going to give up? Or you're gonna, and whether that's zombies coming in through the, you know, through a farmhouse, it's whether it's physical survival or whether it's, you know, a Bukowski about someone who's drink and they're trying to give up the drink, and it's spiritual survival that fascinates me in people, and especially in art. It's what I want to see. I want to see someone at their bottom, but they still go on. Why don't you give up? Why don't you? You know why? Well, you know, it's like in Fight or Flight. Why doesn't Cal just go to another town? Because he can't. Because it's his home. You know, yeah. He can't leave his family, so he's stuck. He has to sort it out. Let's put our characters through hell so we don't have to.
Or so that we know how to survive it.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Yeah. I want to see extreme things so I can see myself, and I may not have ever been fighting a killer shark.
Yeah.
But I know what it's like to be frightened and out of my depth.
Yeah.
You know, that I want to be what is it? Is there a paradox? Is that a paradox? To be transported to another place so I can actually arrive back in myself. More myself. I know, how long?
That's the kite tangle theorem right there, isn't it?
The kite tangle theorem?
I just made it up.
Oh. Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it does, but it's like I don't know how to describe it. It's everything's on a continuum. So it doesn't matter how much pressure or how much stuff or how much change you go through, even if you arrive at a destination on a different path, you're still the same person, you're still the same thing. You've just grown and learned. Hopefully you've grown and you've changed, or because not making a choice about something is still making a choice.
Yep.
And so you might as well choose to do something worthwhile. You might as well push on. You might as well put up with it and still, do you know what I mean? Like, because you can still not choose to do fuck all, and which is choosing to.
It's a great sentence.
Yeah.
Not choose to do fuck all.
which is not face things. And so many people do that. You know what I mean? So many people just don't change anything about them and about themselves, and think that that's okay. And I don't think that is. I don't think that is okay. I think it's important that people continue to go ahead and learn and push and grow. By me saying that not doing anything isn't, I don't mean people in 9-to-5 jobs and doing, or people, you know, that I think that's people with patterns of behavior or patterns where they don't change and they're doing the same thing and getting the same result and wanting something different out of life.
Yeah.
You have to change something, and you have to change whatever it is that you're doing. You have to change something about what you're doing to garner that result, whatever the fuck that may be.
It takes courage, man, to do that.
You have to be courageous in life, and sometimes you have to make tough choices. But at the same time, not making a choice is making a fucking choice. It's not, so... I think that's what I mean by the kite tangle.
All right, that's clear. What's looping back to why write? Well, what else are you going to do? You know, if I don't choose not to write, or I don't write, I'm making the choice not to write. So now I'm living that life.
Right.
Of, you know, guilt and and shame, as opposed to guilt and shame when
thinking,
I write.
Just thinking that you're happy when you're not. And like, I spent years like, oh, fucking about, you know, like, just until I was like, I need to change my situation, you know. So and that's exactly what I did. I changed it and pursued and put the hard work in and decided that this was the life to that was the happiest for me, was the, but also the hardest. You know, and that's okay. Yeah, but the honest things in life are hard, you know.
Oh, hell yeah. It's hard to be an honest honest with yourself, hardest of all. Yeah. I mean, being honest with other people is pretty hard.
And I think that's why people love those kinds of stories like Jaws, is because it's about people going through that cocoon of realization and finding that the journey of growth and is being from starting one place, ending up in another.
Transformation.
Mm. And that's what I think with stories that people can relate to, is because people are going through some sort of transformation in one way or another, and people want to or are.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, ironically, the deepest transformation is being yourself. You know, Luke Skywalker becomes Luke Skywalker. The change of circumstance and stuff happens to him, but the stories I'm drawn to anyway is when someone actually does the work and they arrive at their authentic self, and you see them stand up and go, oh, there you are.
Hey.
That's, again, Joel and Clementine at the end of Eternal Sunshine. They agree. We can't not love each other, so let's go. And that's all encapsulated with just Joel saying, okay, to her in the corridor. And she says back, okay, that's it. We know what they're saying. They're saying, well, let's go.
Let's do this.
You're in front of me. What else are we going to do? That, you know, yeah. hard-earned authenticity. I don't know. That hard-earned you meets the hard-earned me. And we'll be okay. We might fuck up, make mistakes, but it's going to be you and me doing it. So they're going to be honest. So you'll get something from it.
Yeah.
It's when I know, like, to, not to limit it just to writing, but when I'm trying to adorn my writing, I'm trying to be a writer.
Yeah.
I don't even know what the mistakes are teaching me, because they're not my mistakes. I'm trying to make other people's mistakes. So even when I look at something that's kind of awful, I don't know what I've learned from that, because it's not me on the page. I'm trying to be someone else, but maybe trying to be someone else is me in a way.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True, right? I'll say, even in that, there's always something.
Yeah. I fully agree.
It's like your voice is your voice, whatever it is. Is it a choir? Is it today? Is it hip hop? I don't know. It's your voice, but I know I need help with that. I need encouragement, and I need someone just to remind me. Remember the good stuff? That's you.
So what advice would you give to someone that wants to that wants to take a leap with their life and do something that they have put off for a long time or haven't and want to change direction?
Be kind to yourself. What that looks like is you're going to fuck up, because what you're attempting is very, very difficult. Changing a life, it's hard. And it's not going to be a single door and then there's streams of light in your face. I mean, it might be. Good luck to you. That's your experience. But mostly change doesn't feel like what you think it's going to feel like, has been my experience. And you look back and remember the changes and go, oh, that went all right. So have good people around you. What good people means to you will mean it to you. But for me, it means people who can give me the facts in a way that I can hear them.
Well, I do have to say that you are one of the most astonishing writers I've met, and one of the most accomplished as well, and just in how you deal with things and how you edit things, and one of the most brilliant. And I think when I look at change and how to deal with it, I think about that a lot, and I find a lot of inspiration in that, and how you've gone about your life and where you are right now. And I'm very happy to know you, and I think it's a good thing. And well done, incredible, and thank you for being an inspiration to write and to help write and keep things going. It's awesome.
Thanks, man. You're very welcome. It's entirely symbiotic.
Is there anything that you want to pass on and let people know how to get onto the improv thing or anything like that?
Look, jump on Improv Melbourne, Google it. We have shows all the time, and they're going to have something in them that's worth seeing, and it's, I think of the improv shows we do, and in general, it's, remember the Sunday night movie? Remember how you used to just tack off your Sunday night with 2 hours with John Wayne or something? I think that's what that sort of theatre gives now, so it's still there. It's like a couple hours at the end of your weekend, you forget it's Sunday coming into Monday, and you'll go home happy and you've had a good time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, jump on Improv Melbourne. I'm really proud of the shows we do. I think they're worthwhile theatre.
Yeah. Groovy. Too easy. Well, thanks so much for jumping on the show. It's been hasn't felt like an hour and a half.
Ah, 90 minutes.
Like fucking 40 minutes, but
good on
it's
us.
Been a good chat, so thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure, Kieran.
Cool. Thanks, bro.
Okay, there it is. So thanks for listening to the podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe. Heads up, we will hopefully be on iTunes shortly for those people that have Apples, iPhones, etc. We're just working through some technical issues with Squarespace. So we will get there. Stay tuned for some more podcasts coming up. Once again, thank you. Thank you to Tim. And yeah, hang in there. Peace.